I'm good. Ready to go.
Welcome to MicroCollege. My name is Jacob Hunt, and I'm the director of Thoreau College, a microcollege located in beautiful Viroqua, Wisconsin, in the Driftless region of the Upper Midwest. We're recording today from the studios of Community Radio WDRT here in Viroqua, downtown Viroqua. And today, our guest, really honored to have as our guest, Dr. Richard Kite. Before we get to that, I just want to mention that at Thoreau College, we are currently accepting applications for a number of programs, including our fall and spring metamorphosis gap semester programs. If you are in the Upper Midwest or within driving distance, consider coming to our Viroqua Shakespeare Festival, which will be happening last weekend in June. Without any further ado, I'd like to introduce Dr. Richard Kite, who is the endowed professor and director of the D.B. Reinhardt Institute for Ethics and Leadership at Viterbo University in La Crosse, Wisconsin, where he teaches a variety of courses in ethics, dealing with issues in business, leadership, and the environment. He received his undergraduate degree from Hamline University and his Ph.D. in philosophy from the Johns Hopkins University in 1994. Dr. Kite is the author of the forthcoming book, Finding Your Third Place, Building Happier Communities and Making Great Friends Along the Way, which is coming out this summer, 2024. He writes a regular column for Lee newspapers titled The Ethical Life, and he serves on the board of the La Crosse Community Foundation and Leader Ethics Wisconsin. Thank you for joining us, Dr. Kite.
Delighted to be here, Jacob. Thank you.
Yeah, so here on the MicroCollege podcast, we always start in the same way, which is to ask people about their biographies, and particularly their period as a young adult. Here at most of our programs at Thoreau College, we're working with people 18 to 20 years old, usually that age or a little bit older. So I'd like to ask where you were at that age and what were the big influences on your life that have shaped you since?
Well, at 18, I was graduating from Frazee High School, Frazee, Minnesota. It's up near Detroit Lakes on the road to Fargo. It's a home of the world's largest turkey, by the way.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. So that's why it's world famous. The turkey, the first one they built didn't last very long. It burned down. And if you want to Google Frazee turkey fire, you'll read a really interesting story. And it's rebuilt now. So if you ever want to, you know, travel on Highway 10 up towards Fargo and stop and see the turkey, I mean, you might have to wait in line because of the tourists, but you'll be able to see it.
Yeah, put that on your bucket list.
Yeah, there you go. So, came from a very small town, northern Minnesota, and then went to Hamline University with no idea what I wanted to study. I was able to go there because of a scholarship. I started taking classes in anything that sounded interesting and met a couple of professors who were teaching philosophy that I just found their courses fascinating. So I decided I might as well major in that, after graduating, I spent a year in Lancaster University in England, and that's where I met my wife. She was also a student there doing a junior year abroad. We did a lot of hitchhiking together during that year. After graduation, she invited me to come to Colorado and run a miniature golf course with her, and we proceeded to do that for 9 straight summers.
Wow.
Right at the base of Pikes Peak. And then we went to grad school together in Baltimore. And that was a long, long process. But anyway, that's a brief history of my years in the late teens, 20s.
Beautiful. Yes, giant turkeys, mini golf, hitchhiking, and philosophy.
There you go. That's it. Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, so the story of, Hamline University, kind of a classic Midwestern liberal arts college in many ways, going there, finding your way into a love for philosophy. Like, that's what a liberal arts college, liberal arts education is supposed to be like, right?
Yeah.
Is that something that's still possible for people to do?
It's harder for a number of reasons. One is liberal arts programs have shrunk so much. There's very few of them that are really great books programs in the way that I experienced. I was able to read all kinds of primary sources, and this goes back really an age-old tradition of like how you learn the humanities is you read the best that's been written and you you read where ideas came from, right? You don't just read what people think about the ideas now. You do that, of course, but you start out by reading where the ideas came from. So you're reading the pre-Socratics and then Plato and Aristotle and the Stoics and, you know, medieval theologians and, you know, dramatists, studying art history and seeing how ideas originate and how they develop over time. And I think that's a liberal arts education to me.
Mm-hmm.
And so you study things like the sciences, but you also study where the sciences came from. Like I was reading at the time, I was reading Descartes. I was reading Newton, the Principia. Hardly anybody reads Newton now,
yeah.
Right? You know,
yeah.
So reading Einstein, where he explains, you know, the general and special theories of relativity. I understood very little of it, but that was part of the discipline of the liberal arts, was reading things that were impossible, really.
Yeah.
You know, I had no preparation for reading that sort of thing when I was reading it. But the struggle and the discipline that you develop when you read things that you really can't understand at all, and you try to make sense of them. That was really a great education. And what I loved about philosophy was you didn't come into it with any assumptions. Now, of course, there are cultural assumptions and everything else,
mm-hmm.
but you're free to question everything, whereas every other discipline starts with a core set of assumptions that define the discipline. Philosophy is just curiosity, and you're trying to figure, what is knowledge? What is reality? I mean, those are the most basic questions you can ask.
And right? What are your assumptions, too?
Yeah, because that's part of it. Like, when you ask a question, what is reality, do you bring to the very questioning a set of assumptions? And so that's part of the discipline, is asking, what are those assumptions? Whereas there's a lot of other disciplines where they say, well, if you question certain core assumptions, then you're not doing that discipline anymore, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So that's one of the things I loved about philosophy.
Yeah. Yeah, what you're saying really emphasizes a question that comes up quite often as we're designing curriculum for programs in Thoreau College, and I know comes up with other micro colleges and gap year programs and our peers, people I've interviewed on this podcast, which is the role of reading and of texts.
Yeah.
I think because of technology and lives that young people and everyone is leading, it is, you know, that ability to struggle with a difficult text, a long text, is, you know, that's a skill that seems harder to come by in some ways. And as well as we're building programs that are experiential, that we have the arts, we have, you know, outdoors experiences, we have communal governance experiences. But you know, I certainly, as an educator and as a person, love books, and really, you know, what you're describing, that experience of working with texts is essential. So I wonder, you know, if you have a sense about that, you know, to what degree is that essential to building a, you know, the formative kind of liberal arts education you're talking about? And if so, like, how do we up that ability in our students?
Yeah, it's both engaging with the text, and that's something that you do first alone. You're reading it by yourself, trying to figure it out, and then you're talking about them.
Mm-hmm.
So you're engaging with text in a community, and that's essential also, because then you discover that, well, here we are reading the same thing, but we have very different interpretations. We're getting different things out of it. And so how do we reconcile these different views? That becomes really significant and a core part of that education. And I will still have students who, like, are really into reading certain kinds of texts, but it's harder to find a group of people together who want to read them at the same time and talk about them. And then the other thing that I noticed that's happened is just the way in which digital technology has affected our brains. It's harder for all of us to maintain that attention for long periods of time.
Mm-hmm.
And it's like running a marathon. If you're going to read something like Kant's Critique of Judgment, I mean, you've got to... That's hard work.
Yeah.
And you don't start doing that from nothing. That would be like you run marathon for your first race, right? You train for it, and you develop the capacity, and you do the same thing with reading. And I've noticed my ability to maintain focus on a long and difficult text has really dropped sharply. It's because I spend so much time answering emails and, you know, and reading things online, and it just does something to your brain where it's harder to focus. And so this is especially true of younger people who have never in their life developed the habit of reading really long, difficult text. Mm-hmm. And so then you might find the exception here and there, but can they find a community to do it?
Yeah. Yeah. So that is certainly something that I hope, you know, that we're helping to do with our programs. And we definitely see students saying that and seeking that out. And even with a group of people who are saying they want to do it, it's hard enough.
It's hard enough. But then they encourage one another,
yeah.
Right? That, you know, that's being part of a team,
yeah.
Right? Because you're all going through this together. Yep. And then you encourage one another to stick with it. And, you know, and you complain, like, because you start to have really significant self-doubts. You know, maybe I'm just too stupid to understand this, right? And then you realize, well, everybody feels that way.
Right. Think, everyone finds content.
Yeah.
That hard. Yeah.
Yeah. Just impossible. And like, so anyway.
Yeah. Yeah. I really also want to appreciate what you're saying about those science classics, you know, the Newton's Principia and Einstein and thinkers like that and texts like that. I've taught high school science for a number of years and really enjoy handing at least some parts of those sorts of things to students because, yeah, they don't and I don't understand most of it, but some of it you do, and slowly you do build up the capacity to tackle things that seem impossible. And often enough, those thinkers, if they have made great advances in science, have formulated some theory, they are actually great users of language.
Right. Yeah. And you see them, even if you don't understand all that they're saying, you lots of times understand the questions they're asking.
Yeah.
Like, what is light?
Yeah.
Right? I mean, that's an amazing question. And then of course, along with that, what is color? And then you start saying, well, you know, I've always thought of colors as kind of permanent or stable, but then I realized, no, it's the effect of light upon a surface, and it's always changing, depend on the condition of light. And so all of a sudden, color isn't what I was imagining it to be, and this is not a new question. This goes way, way back. And so, like, these really difficult questions that human beings deal with are ones that people have always dealt with, and that's an amazing thought, just that realization.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah, it's exciting to know that, you know, before it was called science, it's natural philosophy, right?
Yes.
And you can see how close that is, right?
Yeah, yeah. The love of knowledge, the love of wisdom about the natural world. That's basically what it is. And you see this in children, right? And they're
absolutely
kind of always wanting to ask questions about things they're perceiving. Some people stay childish their whole life. They keep asking those kinds of questions, and I think that's really wonderful.
Yes, absolutely. Yeah. So one of the things I've admired about you following your career from afar, you're a philosopher. You know, it's not just the vita contemplativa, the life of contemplation. It is also, you're also very much engaged with action in the world, particularly with people a little bit older, with leaders, through the work of the D.B. Reinhardt Institute for Ethics and Leadership. So can you share a little bit about that work and the institute and what sort of things you do there?
Yeah, I came to Viterbo University in the summer of 2000, and I was hired to be the first director of this newly formed institute, the D.B. Reinhardt Institute for Ethics and Leadership. And at the time I was hired, the university didn't have a really clear idea of what they wanted to do with it. Mm-hmm. They had some general goals, but I had a lot of freedom to develop it and how I envisioned it and how it's developed over the past 24 years is a place that brings together both students and the community to ask questions about ethics in the broadest possible sense. That is, any kind of question about what is good or right or true. And so we bring in quite a few speakers over the course of the year, probably in the neighborhood of about 20 different speakers.
Yeah.
that we'll bring to campus. They might be in any kind of discipline. It might be nursing or dietetics or engineering or business or the sciences. We also host some conferences. And then one of the really successful workshops that we've held for the past 17 years now has been on the Holocaust, and it's a workshop for teachers to help them teach the Holocaust, and then we've been bringing in Holocaust survivors. So we do a lot of different things, and then over the years, kind of special. There's a few things that we keep doing again and again because they've proven to be like both really popular and really significant.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So in addition to that Holocaust work, there's also I know you do an Aldo Leopold day focused on environmental issues.
Yeah, I collaborate with the whole community on a kind of community celebration of Aldo Leopold on the first week of March every year. That's really wonderful work. We're finding that more and more young people don't know who Aldo Leopold is, and we're not that far away, right, from Baraboo, where he had the shack, and yet we have a lot of people here in Wisconsin. This is one of the things I find a little disturbing is there's so much emphasis on global knowledge and global perspectives, which in the abstract I think is quite good, but there's always a trade-off. When you devote a whole bunch of time to one thing, you're taking less time on another. And and what we're losing is local knowledge, right? I teach at a university that is 9 blocks away from the Mississippi River. And we have a lot of students that don't spend any time on the river and don't even know that we're right next to the nation's largest wildlife refuge. Like certain basic things like that that they don't know. So every spring when the spring migration of waterfowl is coming up, and it's like I'd like to take students out just to witness it. Like you are a few blocks away from one of the great phenomena in the world is this spring migration of waterfowl. And you've got to get up at sunrise and go see it some morning, right?
Yeah.
So local knowledge, I really want to emphasize that. And I think that's what you do better than anybody else. I mean, like, we're in a way kind of constrained by the disciplines we teach and by the professional requirements of different disciplines. You know, that dictates a lot of the curricula of most colleges and universities, where you have the freedom to say, this is really important right here. It might not be that important, say, in Ohio or California or Texas, but it's really important right here. Let's study it. Right.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, for me also, this is why, you know, this is micro college. The scale is really important because for the scale of the programs that we're doing, you know, 5, 6, up to 12 or 15 students, we can get in a couple of vans and go somewhere and see the migration of the waterfowl or go to harvest ramps as we were doing last week. And also do that in a way that is sustainable, right? If you bring 100 people into a ramp bed, like you can't do that either, right? You need just a handful of people, and that's the right scale. Appropriate scale is I think applies to higher education and to education in general as well as other fields.
Yeah.
So here's your chance. Who's Aldo Leopold, and why was his thought important?
Well, he's this amazing conservationist from Wisconsin who coined the phrase the land ethic, which is in some ways probably the start of real serious thinking about environmental ethics. It's not that people hadn't asked questions about what's good or bad for the land or for the environment. It's just that he was the first one to systematize it and then formulate distinctive answers about how you both get familiarity with the land, and then what we should do to protect it, to ensure a kind of sustainability and health. And then his most famous book was The Sand County Almanac, which was unfortunately didn't really become recognized until after his death, which was far too young. He died of a heart attack while fighting a neighbor's fire. But the Sand County Almanac is one of these remarkable books that stays relevant and stays timely. Even now, we're looking at probably over 80 years since its publication, since its writing, anyway. So So, you know, my top 10 list of books, and that always changes, like what I include in my top 10 list. But Sand County Almanac is up there. And one of the reasons is I can go back to it at any time and reread essays that I'm very familiar with, and I see something new in them all the time. It's just such fertile ground.
Yeah, absolutely. It's on our list. If you go to our website of books that show up often in our curriculum, certainly Aldo Leopold, Sand County Almanac is an important one. And I think it sits well right next to Thoreau's Walden. An interesting thing, they both record the cycle of the seasons in a complete kind of a set. Sand County Almanac is an almanac. Walden records Thoreau's experience in 2 years and 2 months at Walden Pond. Interestingly, they're organized in a different way. Sand County Almanac starts in January and goes through December. It goes through the calendar year, whereas Thoreau begins in the summer and goes through the spring. And so I think there's between those two texts and a few others, including Robin Wall Kimmerer's Breeding Sweetgrass, and there's always something that is happening in the natural world in one of those texts that we are able to bring into our classrooms. And I think, yeah, that's certainly one of my favorite things about the programs we're able to do here.
You know, one question that I've been meaning to ask Kurt Meine, who is Leopold's biographer, and, you know, and if any of you aren't familiar with Kurt Meine's work, you should look it up, because there's a lot of great scholarship on Aldo Leopold, but Kurt Meine probably knows Leopold and his writings better than anybody else.
Yeah.
And I've been meaning to ask him about Emerson's influence on Aldo Leopold, because I notice Leopold doesn't quote many people. Neither did Emerson, by the way. And even when Emerson quoted people, he didn't use quotation marks,
right,
and sometimes didn't use the names. He would, in Emerson's day, there was kind of an understanding that if you are well-read, there was certain text, certain phrases and things you will just recognize, and so you didn't use quotation marks. You just used their phrase, because
right,
any reader would recognize that's what it is. And Leopold does the same thing. There's a number of turns of phrase and expressions they say. I'm thinking that comes right out of Emerson, it's not quite Emerson's words, but he's playing with it. You know, he's changing a couple words, but he's invoking it. He does this with Wordsworth also.
Yeah.
And I think there's a lot of other writers from that time that he's using, which all comes out of his education at Yale, right?
Mm-hmm.
So he had a great books education, right? And this is one of the ways these influences come down, but it's really hard for us to see it anymore, right? Because even those of us who read Emerson and Wordsworth and so forth, we don't have that kind of intimate familiarity with those writers. So
yeah.
I think we miss a lot of what's going on in Leopold's head.
Yeah, no doubt. I mean, that's one reason to engage with the classics, in general, is that they are shaping the contours of our thinking and our language, really, whether we're aware of it or not. I mean, the classic example is Shakespeare and the King James Bible,
right,
phrases and words we use every day that come and are pioneered or to come out of those texts that we use every day. And if you don't know where they're from, then you're missing an important part of their meaning, actually, and you're not communicating as fully as you could.
Yeah. I've been, over the past year or so, I've been reading a small portion of the King James Bible, you know, starting with Genesis. I'm just gradually working my way through, and it's remarkable how many expressions that we still use come out of there that I had no idea came from there. But that's what it takes to find that out, is you just have to work your way through it. And it's just beautiful language.
Yeah. Yeah. I think reading through that text and also many of the plays of Shakespeare, we're doing this summer, Henry V and Romeo and Juliet at the Baroque Shakespeare Festival. And, you know, I hadn't read Henry V in a long, long time. And you go through and you find phrases like, oh, that's from here, right? That's
exactly,
that's a phrase I use every day. Or, you know, that there you come across like that, the origins of things in a way that's really unique.
Yeah. Yeah. It's so fun.
Yeah. Well, so speaking of books, one of the reasons we're excited to talk to you today is you have a new book coming out. And I think, you know, like these classics, you know, Wellsprings, I think you are tapping into something that many people are sensing and feeling. And I've heard this phrase, third place, come up in the last several months, even before hearing about your book. And so it's in the you've tapped into the zeitgeist, I think. So again, the book is called Finding Your Third Place. So, and can you just tell us where when is it coming out, and how can people find it?
The release date is June 25th, the summer, and we're going to do a book signing and a release at Pearl Street Books in downtown La Crosse. It's available for pre-order at Fulcrum Books, fulcrumbooks.com. That's pretty easy to find, and that's kind of what I'm asking people to do is go to your local bookstore and order it, or Fulcrum. You can find it, of course, on places like Amazon or you know, Better World Books, and you know, all the online booksellers as well.
Go to your local bookstore. An important third place. What is a third place?
Third place is where we tend to hang out. So if your first place is home, second place is work, third place is where you go to socialize. And so there are a lot of third places in communities. Their characteristics are that they're open quite a bit, so they're easy to stop into, they're easy to access. They're fun places to be. Mm-hmm. They're very comfortable. It's not a place where you go to dress up to see people or be seen. It's just where you go to. It's like a second home. And then the thing that gives third places their character is there's usually some regulars, some people that are there all the time.
Yeah.
And so one of the things that defines a third place, it doesn't have to necessarily be, say, a coffee shop or a tavern or a gym, but those are the locations that are most often third places because they're the kind of places where people are going on a regular basis, say at least once a week, and they're running into both the same people on a regular basis, but also meeting new people there. And the term has been around since 1989. A sociologist named Ray Oldenburg wrote a book called The Great Good Place. Mm-hmm. And it got some traction. It entered the vocabulary, but it didn't become really popular. And then during the pandemic, when a lot of third places closed, and you know, people were isolated for a while, and they were really starting to recognize the loss of venues for social interaction. That's when the term kind of exploded into popularity, and I'd written a few pieces about third places. I've been writing columns for 15 years now, and over the years, I'd written some pieces, especially about third places, or at least mentioning them. And I've been teaching this in a course I do on building community for probably 15 years or so. Mm-hmm. And I would get more reaction to those columns than to anything else. I could even write about really controversial things, but third places, people really resonated. They wanted to talk more about that. And so the publisher here for Fulcrum just reached out to me and he said, you know, why don't you write a book on that? And it wasn't anywhere on my radar. And then I started thinking, you know, I started looking around for finding other books that were written as really on this topic. And there was these two books by Ray Oldenburg from late 80s and early 90s. And then there's very little else. And I thought, well, there's actually a gap. I'm not a sociologist, but you know, but I'll give that a shot. And so then I spent a couple years working on this. So and it's been actually really rewarding.
Yeah, I imagine. It seems like a really important theme. I think another work that's reminding me of a key work in my own master's thesis work, which was about education here in Viroqua, actually was Bowling Alone by Robert Putnam, which talked about the decline of voluntary organizations and, you know, civic kind of engagement through things like bowling leagues and fraternal orders like the Masons or the Lions, churches, you know, organizations that often also were associated, I think, with third places, or they're places where this kind of interaction happened in some way.
Bowling Alone is really, you know, it became famous. It was the phrase bowling alone just entered into the vocabulary amazingly. He came out with that book in 2000, and Putnam, who's a Harvard psychologist, he was looking at the decline of what he called social capital, which is one way to describe that is generalized trust in a community. So looking at that decline along with decline of civic engagement, and he located it really in the loss of places like bowling alleys. Well, that's the sort of thing that Oldenburg had been talking about a decade before, uh-huh. is the loss of these social gathering places. Putnam put it in a broader social context of, well, it's not just those places like cafes and taverns and bowling alleys, although that's kind of, that's the face of it. That's where we really see it. But there's also a loss of people just knowing their neighbors and talking to their neighbors, and loss of volunteering and voting and all sorts of things. Service organizations like Rotary, Kiwanis Lions, mm-hmm. Moose and Elk Lodges, those sorts of things. Those are all diminishing, you know, decade after decade. So Putnam put this thing that Oldenburg had named as third place, he put it into this broader context, and then was showing how, like, all kinds of bad things happen when you lose social capital. Like, the quality of education goes down, the quality of healthcare goes down, children aren't doing as well in such communities, crime goes up, even tax fraud mm-hmm. goes up when you have lower social capital. So he put it in this context of saying, well, it's not just that we're feeling lonelier. It's also just bad for us as a society.
We're actually sicker
sicker
and unsafe in ways that we weren't before because of this.
Yeah, and even like, and this is one of the reasons why even places where crime has been declining, and you know, we've had a few decades of declining crime rates, mm-hmm. people feel less safe,
yeah.
right? Because they're not out experiencing it for themselves. They're mostly reporting what they're hearing on television because they're not actually physically engaged with their community. And so they're reporting that things are less safe, which causes them to withdraw even more. And actually, it's safer, you know? And then you have people like Richard Louv coming along, you know, like a decade after that, writing Last Child in the Woods, talking mm-hmm. about how this fear of engagement with the outer world doesn't just extend to social places. It extends to nature as well. You know, like, we're so afraid of bad things happening to our children, you know, getting Lyme disease or getting bit by a snake or a spider or something, that we keep them indoors, which ends up being much worse for them, right?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, I remember, you know, a year or so ago, we did a program, a first, you know, shorter program, really designed for current college students, and we had a partner, a major university in an urban center, who, that as we were planning this out, the first piece of advice was, you, as we're bringing people into rural Wisconsin, into the woods, into, you know, getting your hands in the soil, a lot of people are going to experience a lot of anxiety about insects, right? And
yeah.
and not just the deer ticks, which maybe you should have some anxiety about, but all kinds of insects. And,
right.
and you know, so thinking about introducing the natural world to people in a way that is, you know, can become familiar with it is also, I do think, is an important part of what we are doing with our programs.
Yeah, yeah. So I mean, another kind of broad word you can use is just like engagement. Mm-hmm. And it's engagement with other people, but it's also engagement with the natural world. And they go hand in hand, because when we're afraid of either one, what we do is retreat into a private life. And what we see as people retreat into a private life, they become more lonely, for one thing, although the loneliness doesn't always exhibit itself as a need for loneliness. It can take the form of like depression and anxiety, which yeah. are like closely related, but also just hunger, like physical hunger, like needing to snack and so forth, something to fill us up because we aren't filled socially, right? And so there's a variety of kind of ailments that we're finding in society that are probably attributable to our to, to are trying to stay inside and lead a more private life, which isn't to say, like, there's certain aspects of private life that can be quite meaningful and rewarding. It's not to say that, and it's not to say that there's something wrong with introverts. I happen to be an introvert myself, but we all need social interaction, and we all need the natural world both. And so we need to push ourselves to go out and engage more.
Yeah, this is obviously a topic that has deep, deep roots in philosophy. I'm thinking about, you know, the ancient Greeks. You know, I know that the ancient Greek word for a private person was an idiot, right?
Yes,
right. Yeah. A person who does not, you know, who stands apart basically from the community in some way. And Henry David Thoreau famously went and sought out solitude, and he was regarded as very strange for doing that, right? And people asked him, "Are you not afraid of solitude?" And I think that is, reading that with students now, it seems odd, that response, because isn't everyone in solitude all the time? Isn't that actually where people start?
Yeah. Yeah. And you know, Thoreau's work is odd in a way, because we think of him as somebody who's going far away into retreat in a cabin all by himself. Of course he wasn't.
Right.
He has this little cabin, but he's, you know, he's walking over to the Emersons, and he's playing with their kids, and he's going into town all the time. And
people are visiting him all the time. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. And then he's got this combination of solitude, which allows him to be a really close observer, both of nature and of his own mind, right? It's so much of his writing is observation about how his mind is working under different conditions. Right. And so, but he's interacting and he's talking with people all the time, right? So conversation is also really important for Thoreau.
Yeah. Yeah. So that leads us back to third places. I mean, so, you've talked about, you know, the loss of social capital and loss of the density of social networks, and the impacts of that. Why are some of the reasons, you know, again, some of the third places you talk about here are give us some examples.
So they're, well, wherever we tend to hang out. So coffee shops and pubs or taverns, brew pubs, those sorts of things. Those are obvious examples, maybe cafes, but also gyms. And, mm-hmm. and especially in many cities now, gyms for a lot of young people, pickleball courts are becoming really popular third places. And it's partly because of the social nature of the game, the way that people mm-hmm. trade teams and partners, and so there's this regular interaction. Parks have become really important third places, churches, libraries and bookstores to some extent. Of course, it depends on what they do and how they're structured and organized.
Right.
Like, so there are certain bookstores or certain libraries that are really, organized for social interaction, and mm-hmm. there's others that are not. They're just organized like for private experience. But so depending on how they're run and kind of the community they're located in.
Yeah, who the regulars are too. The regulars are important.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
More and more independent bookstores also have a coffee shop integrated inside them or next door to them, like so that they become places where you go and you hang out and you talk about books and things like that. So that's really cool.
It's striking how, you know, the Pearl Street Books in La Crosse, the Driftless Books here in Viroqua, these independent used or just independent booksellers have, you know, many of them, a number of them have survived despite predictions of their demise because of the social function, and people enjoy meeting each other and encountering each other that they can't in a mega store. Those spaces are really, you know, an important piece of the story. In your book, the little excerpt I was able to read, you do a beautiful job of describing the physical setup of communities, suburban and urban kind of settings, and how that the physical design of communities actually contributes to the loss or the presence of third places.
Yeah, yeah, and there's been a lot of really good writing, good scholarship on the ways in which we've created a demise of third places, partly by zoning laws,
mm-hmm.
Partly by committing ourselves so fully to the automobile as the kind of the only mode of transportation. Like, there's many cities right now that are, it's very hard to walk around in them. And so, like, both public transportation and walking involve you in interacting with strangers, or your car does not. But what happens when the car becomes the, like, the primary mode of transportation in cities, then commercial buildings become located all together in clusters. And mm-hmm. so we zone for that. So people drive oftentimes alone to do their commercial transactions, oftentimes in drive-thrus.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And so what we're finding is, you know, there are many cities and even smaller towns where there's
every day to survive Israel's 7-month long war.
Oop.
That has thus far
Yeah. Sorry. Can we keep on going, you think?
Yeah, I might walk back.
Okay, fine. Where were we?
So one of the things I've noticed with many towns and cities where new development is taking place is you drive through all this development, which is built for the car, and there are no gathering spaces. And even on beautiful days, you won't see anybody outside gathering and talking. And it's not until you get inside the town to the parts that were built 100 years ago where you find people gathering. Like, they're in parks or they're at a baseball field or something like that where they're standing around talking.
Yeah.
But, like, we forget how important that is for our health. And so there's a lot of good books. And one I want to recommend, Charles Marone from Strong Towns. Mm. You know, it's a really good website with a lot of information. He's got a podcast and he's got several books writing about, like, why it's an economically dumb idea to build cities just for cars.
Yeah.
Like, you need to build so that people are interacting and they're close together. Economically, it makes more sense, but they're also just happier places.
Yeah. Yeah, you can feel that in them. I mean, I think, you know, to bring it around to colleges and universities, you know, you spend much of your life on a university campus. And I've been taking students, high school students, and visiting, you know, college campuses for a long time. And they're wonderful places to be precisely because of the variety and the way that they function as large third places in a lot of ways.
Yeah.
I think since the pandemic, especially, there's a way that isn't always how people experience them. You know, if there are people doing things on their screens, or they're actually remote in some way, and they're just not in the habit of interacting in that way. I wonder, in your career, have you seen changes in the way that people use the spaces on a campus?
Quite a bit. I mean, one of the unfortunate things is there's more and more remote classes, and this is really since the pandemic, more remote classes and those kinds of offerings has diminished on-campus life just because there isn't the density in a lot of places. But apart from that, I would say one of the things I've noticed is a real difference in different campuses. Some campuses understand that there needs to be a lot of really small kind of gathering places where students can get together in small groups and meet and just hang out. And this is especially important if you have commuter students who are coming on campus for the day and they need a place to hang out. And then there has to be some kind of amenities, like some food or coffee or something like that. And there are other universities that don't really get this at all. And so they'll build these fancy big student unions, they'll call them, right? And they're big and glitzy, and they've got really tall ceilings and lots of glass, and then, you know, like a bunch of sofas or chairs like that are out in the middle, right? Where it's a very uncomfortable to be in the middle of a big open place and to sit and have a conversation with somebody. First of all, because you're just exposed, and as human beings, you like to be in intimate spaces when you're sitting down for a conversation, and so you tend not to get people gathering there to talk about their classes or their social life or whatever is going on, what you get is people sitting down in those places like with their laptop or their cell phone or something, but not talking, not in conversation. Right. So I've noticed, and this started happening maybe about 20 years ago, these really big, extravagant, fancy-looking buildings that are not at a human scale, mm-hmm. are not designed for conversation. But other places kind of get it, and they've resisted that trend and have, instead of building like just one big building for all students to gather, but in inhospitable ways, they have all these little cubbies and these different gathering places around the campus that kind of are discovered, like, and this is part of the fun of being a student at this place, is you discover all these little hangouts.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah, I think a lot of people can resonate with that experience. And I mean, there, something you're pointing to, there's a classic book, A Pattern Language, which has come up on this podcast a few times before. That, what kind of spaces create that feeling, those spaces for conversation, for intimate, you know, convivial experiences. There, it's not, space is not generic. It's not absolute. It is, you know, their spaces are different. The qualities of the spaces are different depending on the outcomes and the goals you'd like to have. If you want to have good conversations, you need the right spaces for them.
I first heard the term third places at a coffee shop called Common Grounds, which is next to the Baylor University campus. I was at this conference at Baylor in Waco, Texas, and I ran into an old friend, and we decided to skip some of the afternoon sessions and go to this coffee shop. And the coffee shop is an old house, and that I think it was a two-story house. I can't remember exactly, but it's an old Victorian-style house, you know, with all these little rooms. So you go and get your coffee, and then there's all these little rooms with little tiny tables and chairs, and so you go find a corner somewhere where you can sit and have a conversation, and that's. Those are the ideal kind of places, right? For sharing stories and to feel comfortable and not being pressured to get out. Mm-hmm. And this is what I find is there's a lot of places where that are built for customers to come in and have a meal or coffee or something like that, but they're just too noisy. They've got loud music, or they're echoey, and you just feel uncomfortable in them, right? And so you don't stick around. You don't hang out.
Yeah, and all of this, I think, also points for me to the question of the art of conversation, right? You got to have the right space. You got to have the right kind of layout of time. And then you need, this is skill, actually. There is an art and a skill to having a conversation. And so as we bring students together, these are, again, small groups, handfuls of people, you know, half a dozen to a dozen young people, sometimes very international from very different backgrounds. And, you know, it takes a lot of work, really, in the first few weeks. We go on camping trips, a lot of campfire time, to get into the mode where people are able to converse in the ways that you're talking about. You know, along with reading, perhaps, also something needs to be, you know, worked on, kind of worked up to in a way in these days.
Yeah, there's a kind of confidence. You need to develop a confidence in your own voice and a trust in the others, you know, that you aren't going to be attacked or threatened by something you say.
That's something you definitely hear from young people, right? Of saying the wrong thing.
Yeah. Yeah. Our young people are, they're deep conformist, you know, for all the attention that right now is going on about the protests and so forth. Mm-hmm. I mean, this is the most conformist generation that I've encountered since I've been alive. And they're really attuned to other people's judgments about them. But that means you have to take a long time to build relationships and build trust, especially when you're talking about controversial things.
Right.
And I teach ethics classes. So in a 14-week semester, I'll spend 6 weeks just building up relationships before we can talk about really difficult issues. And then you had mentioned before size, you know, in a micro college, there's a kind of optimal size for that. And I found the same thing. If you have a big class, you can't really develop the relationships that allow most people to feel comfortable in venturing honest opinions about controversial things. Yeah. It has to be small enough where they know one another.
Yeah, absolutely. That's really high on the reasons that I value small size. People are coming into these spaces without without an experience of being able to trust the people that they're around. If they're in a class, I hear so often from people in from large mainstream high school or university contexts, really experiences being shot down for saying something a little bit, or saying anything really. It doesn't even have to be particularly controversial. The expectation is that you don't speak up, and that's really just killing to the intellectual and social life of a college or any community.
I've noticed it with my younger colleagues also that I think partly as being a senior faculty member now and being somebody whose words maybe carry more weight than I realize they have, mm-hmm. I have to be really careful because I don't really care that much anymore about what other people think of me, and I don't mind sharing my opinion. And what I expect is I'll go ahead and share opinions about controversial things all day long. I just, if you don't like it, I expect you to tell me, and then right. We can have a really good argument about it, which I enjoy, yeah. Right?
Right.
But I found that like not everybody shares that attitude, right? Yeah. At least initially, yeah. Have to let the relationship grow a little bit. So
yeah.
You know, the word conversation comes from the Latin words convertere, to turn together.
Yeah.
And it's one of my favorite words in the English language because it's you can see when people are in a really good conversation is they're really locked into one another. They are turned together.
Yeah.
And when they're angry with one another, they turn away, which yeah. is like our word for that is that's avitare or aversion, right? It's like people are turned away. You avert your eyes when you don't like somebody, or you're dismissive, or you know, or suspicious of somebody, yeah. And so, I just love the word conversation because the very word indicates the action of turning together, in with words, but then also turning together in understanding of something.
Yeah, I guess to add to that, we would say university, right? A turning is one, right? That same verse, that turning is there.
Yeah, that verse, that vertere, that Latin word, it plays such a vital role in so many descriptions of human conduct and human institutions.
Right. Absolutely. Yeah. So true to form, Dr. Kite, the little excerpt. I'm looking forward to the book, being able to read it in full. You're not content enough to describe the quality of third places and lament their disappearance and the struggles there, but you've got some really good like concrete advice about how to go. And the title of the book is Finding Your Third Place. So,
yeah.
What can you say about that? How do you find your third place?
Well, let me back up just a bit and say I start out the book talking about why are we so unhappy? Like what happened? Because there's a lot of people, especially younger people and younger writers, and I'm talking to people all the way up into their early 30s, who like to say it's because the world, it really is so bad. Mm-hmm. I don't think that's the case. And I kind of document like what was going on the year I was born, 1962. We've got a nuclear threat from Khrushchev. And like I remember as a kid, there were neighbors who had built nuclear bomb shelters and stocked it with, you know, canned food and so forth because the Cuban Missile Crisis and all those things are going on. And like Russia could send missiles anytime. Rachel Carson's book comes out, Silent Spring, talking about like in a few years, we might not have any birds at all on our planet. Like we're facing just ecological destruction. Air pollution and water pollution are so bad that in December of 1962, 400 people died in 1 week's time in London because of air quality, yeah. Just from breathing the air. I mean, and yet most people in my parents' generation were not depressed about that. Yeah. None of them were talking about maybe we shouldn't have kids because the world won't be here in another 30 years. I mean, they weren't having the reactions that this generation is having. Mm-hmm. And so something else is going on. It's not just that we face threats, and I think we do face some really serious threats, mm-hmm. And some of the same threats, but we have a different attitude about it. And I think what's changed is technology, mm-hmm. And what we see is that friendship has been declining every decade for 200 years. This isn't something new.
200 years.
200 years. This is like the Enlightenment. What it does is we develop the scientific method, but then we start developing tools to kind of change the world that we're living in. And this is like the technological revolution comes along with the Industrial Revolution. And the pace of change has really been increasing, especially since World War II. But the change has been going on for a long time, and it's coterminous with the Enlightenment, so the last 200 years. So the word self appears more every single decade in books that wow. get published over the last 200 years. The word friend declines, and they cross paths around 1900.
Wow.
That's when the two words were used at about the same frequency. So first of all, I want to say, you know, things happened during the pandemic. Things have happened because of social media and smartphones and things like that. But what they did is really speed up the pace of change. Change has been happening for a long time. And so once we recognize that what's going on is our feeling of connection to other people is declining because of technology, then you can say, well, how does technology do it? Well, it does it by making us less dependent on one another,
mm-hmm.
right? Technology increases our freedom and our power, which makes us more independent. And so then when you look, so like every generation is more independent than the last generation. Each generation grows up a little more slowly than the previous one because, well, there's not as much social interaction, there's not as much responsibility for things, right? So you look at it in that context, and then you think, oh, so what's going on is that I've got all this freedom, I've got more independence, and that means it's easier to make choices about what I want in my immediate future that seemed good to me at the time, but then I step back and look, well, what are the effects on myself and on others is, well, we're not as happy because we're really deeply social animals. That's what we are. And this goes back to, you know, Aristotle, right? What's the origin of politics? Well, it's the family, mm-hmm. it's the neighborhood, it's the community. So our politics is not functioning well, we're less happy, all these things. And it's not just because of what one generation has done. It's not because our schools are teaching the wrong things. Like all the things that politicians complain about,
mm-hmm.
it's not those things. It's technology itself,
mm-hmm.
which is kind of fundamental to how we live.
Mm-hmm.
So then you have to say, okay, is there a way to live with technology and not have it ruin our lives? And I think it is possible, but then we have to do it intentionally in a way that our ancestors didn't, because our ancestors were forced into cooperation because they were really dependent on each other for their survival. I'm not really dependent on interacting with my neighbors for my survival in mm-hmm. the same way that my grandparents were, for example.
Yeah, absolutely.
And so what I have to do then is create the dependency. Create the conditions in which I interact with others on a regular basis. And so then when it goes to like, so third places are where we do that, mm-hmm. and it's the easiest way to do it in our contemporary society because our workplaces have become more private in a way. A lot of people, you know, working remotely or they're sitting at their desk having lunch. Yeah.
They're not doing a barn raising or a threshing bee or something like that.
Even potlucks and things. You know, and you talk to older employees at many workplaces and they miss the social nature of work.
Yeah.
Right? And our homes are not as social either. I just remember, you know, growing up in a small town, my grandparents, people would just stop in.
Yeah.
You know? So every weekend, they had to be ready. They'd have some dessert, they'd have coffee ready to go because they never knew who was just going to stop by.
Yeah.
Like, people don't do that. It's some small towns and country areas, but, like, especially in cities.
You don't even call someone on the phone without letting them know that you're going to call them, right?
Yeah, yeah. You text them first right. and say, can I call you?
Exactly.
Yeah, yeah. I've got 30 seconds. Call me right now.
Right.
Right. So the first thing is to recognize that we've lost that push in our lives to be dependent on others, but our happiness depends on it. So then we have to create it artificially.
Right.
And so then you say, okay, are there things I like to do where other people who like to do those things gather? Are there book clubs? And if I don't know about them, well, who would know? Well, mm-hmm. library would know, or the bookstore probably would know. Then if you have a few friends or even a few acquaintances, they're probably in the same boat as you. So why don't you just get together with them on a regular basis for coffee? And don't say, let's just get together for coffee. You talk to like three or four people and say, would you like to gather like every Wednesday morning at 7 o'clock for coffee?
Mm-hmm.
Or would you like to meet after work at 5 o'clock every day at this brew pub? You know, that sort of thing, where you make it regular.
Intentionally, right? And that's, yeah, certainly something we get from Henry David Thoreau also. I think that's a signature of our time. We do need to do things on purpose, deliberately, intentionally, in a way that people maybe in the past didn't.
Yeah, because they were forced into it. I wouldn't say they were forced into friendship, but in a way, they're forced into situations in which friendship naturally resulted,
mm-hmm.
in a way that we are not. And then the other thing is join. You gotta join. Church membership has greatly declined, service organizations, but like even things like book clubs,
mm-hmm.
you know. It is a hassle to make a commitment like every week to a certain time to go somewhere and go to meetings, and then you have to volunteer for things. But if you do that, and then you look back and you realize, oh, I've met so many interesting people that I would have never met otherwise.
Yeah, absolutely. And one of the things we're able to bring our students into here in Viroqua is a community of joiners. People who've gotten together. That was what my master's thesis was about, basically. And it takes the form of schools or education, but also now lots of other, you know, of those civic organizations, which are relatively new, and people join them. And students sense it when they walk into this town right away. They're like, people yeah. say hello to them, and they invite them to do things. So they ask them to volunteer for something. And you have a quality of social life, and friendships emerge from that in a way. And I think it does take that step, that uncomfortable step of saying, yeah, I'll come, I'll join that. I'll show up to that and make a commitment to it.
Yeah, yeah. And, you know, I find some people are really smart about this. They move into a new community, and they just join places. Something.
Yeah.
And, you know, like within a year, they've got a circle of friends.
Yeah.
And there aren't really deep friends yet, but they've got people that they can go and hang out with and talk to. And then if something happens to them and they need help, they know who they can call.
Yeah.
And then others, you know, struggle for years and years and years and don't know how to make friends. Well, you don't make good friends overnight.
Yeah.
In fact, there's a lot of research on this. Like the for the most part, the number of close friends that somebody will have at age 50 is highly correlated with the number of acquaintances you had at 20. Because it takes time for friendships to develop, and for all the people you meet, there's only a handful that are going to become really close friends.
Yeah.
And you don't know who those are in advance, so you have to meet a lot of people.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, so we're at time here for our conversation here today, but those are such wise and important words, and I think I do see it part of what we're doing, and micro colleges like this, they are creating context for young people to have those, to find some more acquaintances and definitely some deep friendships as well.
Some friendships,
and we see students maintain our alumni over wide distances, maintaining connections, visiting each other. And I think a lot of it comes not of them sitting in a classroom or even, you know, doing a formal activity, but is all the space in between those things that are, you know, when you do have open space to have meals together, to travel around together, to just to have to play in some form, you create a space that other those more profound relationships can build, and I think definitely see that as part of our mission.
Yeah, our closest friends are the people that we go through some kind of adventure with. That's why so many close friends are formed in college and they become lifelong friends.
Yes.
Because during that time, when we're becoming who we are, we're becoming who we are in the company of others, right? And so those people like know things about us, about where we came from and where we're going that nobody else knows, because we became ourselves together. And that's and one of the things I like to, you know, remind my students of is that about the time that they're graduating, you know, like you're going to travel off, you're going to get a new job in some new community, go and join and then do something active with others. Like as long as you're learning, as long as you are expanding who you are and you're doing it in the company of others, you're going to make friends in that process because you're doing that. You're becoming who you are together.
Yes, absolutely. Those are such wise words, and really, really grateful to you, Dr. Kite, for coming and speaking with us. Everyone should get out there, go to Fulcrum Books or to your local bookstore and find Finding Your Third Place, and then go find your third place.
Yeah.
Thank you so much for joining us.